Summer begins while Virginia is still under phase two of a plan to gradually reopen the economy, in part because there have been consequences in other parts of the country.
There have been surges in other states that have eased restrictions prematurely.
Meanwhile, the pandemic continues to affect Black and Brown communities in higher numbers than the rest of the population. On Thursday, the Northam administration sought to address the issue.
Como sabemos, la comunidad latina de Fairfax está siendo afectada desproporcionadamente por la propagación de COVID-19.
This is the Charlottesville Quarantine Report for June 22, 2020. On today's show, Lee Catlin interviews Cynthia Hurst, the director of the Foothills Child Advocacy Center. We also hear about how COVID-19 has affected traffic volumes.
All vehicle volumes declined sharply in mid-March after the work from home started.
I'm Sean Tubbs, the creator of the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Let's get on with the show. The percentage of positive COVID-19 tests in Virginia continues to decline and is currently at 6.5% of all results. That's down from 10% 2 weeks ago. This morning, the Virginia Department of Health has reported another 1,022 new cases, the highest one-day total in the past 2 weeks. The number of fatalities in Virginia is now at 1,620. In the Thomas Jefferson Health District, there were 15 new cases reported today for a cumulative total of 799. University of Virginia students who want to live on grounds for the upcoming semester need to notify officials of their intent by July 1st. The Cavalier Daily reports that the administration sent out more details about how the university will return in the fall, including a requirement that masks be worn in all public spaces. A testing plan will also be developed that will include an app where students, faculty, and staff will be required to track symptoms. Students who don't wish to return during the pandemic may continue to receive instruction online. The Central Virginia Small Business Development Center is reminding area businesses that there are still billions of dollars remaining in the federal Paycheck Protection Program. The Central Virginia SBDC is part of the Community Investment Collaborative and provides training and free one-on-one confidential counseling for small businesses. The group is offering to counsel businesses about how they might access the PPP program. They're also reporting that the Fluvanna County Board of Supervisors has allocated $350,000 to an initiative called Funds for Recovery and Operations Management, or FRUM. The money is intended for businesses in Fluvanna County. On Thursday, June 18th, Governor Ralph Northam moved the location of his regular press briefing from Richmond to the meeting room of the Fairfax County Board of Supervisors. All of Virginia is now in phase two of the Forward Virginia plan, but the theme of this most recent briefing centered around how COVID-19 is affecting one demographic more than others.
We are here today to talk about what we're doing to help our Latino communities fight this virus.
We'll come back to that issue shortly. But first, Northam had details about what phase three might look like in Virginia. Northam was not ready to move forward this past weekend.
While the statewide numbers are trending in a positive direction, we need to continue to evaluate the data. But people need and they deserve to be able to plan. So I want Virginians to see what phase three will generally look like when we do make that decision.
Under phase three, Virginians will still be asked to stay at home when possible, especially if you're at risk and have underlying health conditions.
It means we still strongly encourage teleworking. People still need to focus on physical distancing in all situations outside of their home. Face coverings are still the right thing to do in indoor public spaces.
The number of people who can be at a social gathering will increase to up to 250 under phase three. There will no longer be a cap on the number of people who can enter a retail establishment or a restaurant, though physical distancing is still going to be required. But a whole new class of businesses can reopen under limited capacity in phase three.
Entertainment venues like museums, zoos, and other outdoor venues may open at 50% capacity. with a cap of 1,000 people. Gyms and fitness centers may be open up to 75% of capacity.
Overnight summer camps will remain closed. Swimming pools can increase to 75% of capacity. And keep your mask on.
Studies increasingly show how effective face coverings can be to reduce the spread of this virus. But we all need to wear them and wear them properly.
Northam is being cautious, in part because other states across the nation are seeing spikes in cases.
As you have seen, there have been surges in other states that have eased restrictions prematurely, and I am monitoring those very closely. As we do, I want to emphasize to every Virginian, just because something is allowed doesn't mean it's required. If a business doesn't feel comfortable opening or can't meet the requirements, it does not have to open. And just because there are more places to go does not mean you have to go there. We still need to consider where we need to go versus where we may want to go. We still need to be careful when we are out in the public.
As more people are moving around the Commonwealth, it's important to note that the COVID-19 pandemic is having a disproportionate impact on some segments of the population.
Latino people, interesting, these are interesting numbers, make up 45.3% of the cases for which we have demographic data, and 35% of hospitalizations, even though Hispanic and Latino people make up just about 10% of our population here in the Commonwealth. Clearly, Latino communities are disproportionately affected by this virus. Overall, the Latino population is more likely to be uninsured than the general population. Latino people are more likely to work in jobs that put them at higher risk of contracting the virus. These risk factors are compounded within the Latino undocumented population.
Northam said outreach efforts are being increased, including a media campaign to get into Spanish language outlets. There will also be community testing events, particularly targeted toward the uninsured.
Our Health Equity Working Group is tracking the data and working to make sure we are connecting with communities that are at a greater risk. And we are all using a health equity lens to make these decisions.
The pandemic crisis comes at a time when federal immigration officials are aggressively enforcing an interpretation of immigration law that seeks to remove as many undocumented people from the country as possible. Speaking in Northern Virginia, Northam thanked Prince William County officials for ending a practice of reporting the status of people arrested. Let's listen.
I also want to acknowledge the action by Prince William County to end its 287G program. In which local law enforcement was collaborating with federal ICE officials and reporting the immigration status of people arrested. I hope that this will help set a new tone of trust and support with our Latino communities.
But wait, there's more.
And I think we can all celebrate today's Supreme Court ruling to extend DACA protection. In case that wasn't clear about what we're applauding, I will repeat that. I want to thank all of us who can thank and celebrate today's Supreme Court ruling to extend DACA protections. DACA recipients have built their lives here in our country, and they make this a better Commonwealth.
There's a link in the show notes to the many presentations made in Spanish last Thursday. Please do seek that information out and see if you can share it with someone who needs to know it. For now, let's hear one member of the Fairfax County Board of Supervisors, Dalia Palchik.
Hola, buenas tardes. Yo soy Dalia Palchik, representante del Distrito de Providence, aquí en el condado de Fairfax, y la primera latina elegida aquí en el condado. Como sabemos, la comunidad latina de Fairfax está siendo afectada desproporcionadamente por la propagación de COVID-19. Y sobre todo, vemos impactos económicos y en la salud. Además de los comentarios del presidente McKay y de las iniciativas del gobernador de Northam sobre las pruebas y el apoyo financiero a las personas sin fines de lucro, me gustaría compartir el trabajo del condado de Fairfax en tres áreas para apoyar a nuestra comunidad latina. Número uno, el programa de asistencia de alquiler. El condado y nuestras organizaciones sin fines de lucro están trabajando para apoyar con las necesidades básicas de todos nuestros residentes aquí en Fairfax. Del 1 de marzo al 22 de mayo, se prestó asistencia de vivienda a 816 familias por un total de $686,000. Sabemos que hay más trabajo para hacer y que más familias aún necesitan nuestro apoyo. Las personas que viven en Fairfax y necesitan asistencia con vivienda o otra asistencia pueden comunicarse con el número de planificación aquí de servicios coordinados. Ese número es el 703-222-0880.
At the end of the press conference came more questions from reporters. Let's hear one of them.
We have a question from Alan Sieberman with the Associated Press. He said, what is your best guess for when phase three will start?
Yes. The question is, what is our best guess when phase three will start? Tomorrow is the 19th. Next Friday will be the 26th. That would be the earliest, the 26th of June. But again, I am watching closely what is going on in other parts of our country, and we will continue to follow our data. And as soon as we can do it safely and responsibly, we will, but certainly not before June the 26th.
The Commonwealth Transportation Board is a statewide agency that makes decisions about funding and policy on roads, sidewalks, railroads, and other forms of what planners refer to as mobility infrastructure. On Wednesday, June 17th, they were briefed on how mobility restrictions created by the COVID-19 pandemic affected the number of people moving around Virginia.
We started seeing the reductions in travel throughout the Commonwealth. We had asked our traffic engineering staff and our operations staff to be able to continue to monitor the effects of COVID-19 on our traffic volumes.
The information comes from VDOT's traffic monitoring system, which has 512 continuous count stations spread all across Virginia. Governor Ralph Northam declared a state of emergency on March 12th. A month later, on April 12th, traffic volumes reached their lowest level, a statewide average of 64% below normal.
All vehicle volumes declined sharply in mid-March after the work from home started.
That's Mina Lockwood, an engineer in VDOT's traffic engineering division.
The max percent change is shown there as -64% on Sunday, April 12th. And from about that point, there's a gradual increase as volumes approach typical.
Truck traffic declined as well and hit its lowest point of 30% on Easter Sunday, April 12th. That's the day of the lowest traffic volume so far. Lockwood said volumes have been trending upwards ever since. VDOT has 9 districts, and Lockwood said behavior in all of them was not uniform.
In some of the rural districts like Lynchburg, volumes did not decline as sharply as the more urban district like Nova. Traffic in Nova is going up at a much more gradual rate than the other districts as well.
Lockwood said by the end of May, volumes were back up, especially during peak times. Still, the number of vehicles was still down.
We see these increases in peak period traffic as more workers return to daily commute, but since schools remain closed and we don't have the added school traffic in the morning, we don't see the complementary high morning traffic yet. We probably won't until those other things happen, like schools reopen and more people are doing their daily commute.
However, truck traffic is already back to normal levels. Lockwood does say that these trucks are currently experiencing less congestion. Lockwood offered up some analysis of how different parts of Virginia have been affected differently.
Several other rural counties have not had the steep declines we've seen statewide. Shenandoah only dipped to about -30%. Chances are more people are teleworking in the urban jurisdictions. And looking at the largest employers in Shenandoah, there's essential businesses, and there's a lot of locations where you can't telework, like health systems and such. So it makes sense that their numbers have not decreased as much.
Some other observations from the June 17th Commonwealth Transportation Board presentation. Congestion is down in metro areas. Speeds have been slower. And lower volumes have also meant fewer vehicle crashes. There were about 2,300 crashes during the week of March 4th. Compare that to about 1,200 crashes the week of April 1st.
We have seen a downward trend in total crashes that is very similar to volumes. And you can see that they are going down. And then as the volume goes back up, the crashes are also starting to go back up.
Jennifer Mitchell is director of the Virginia Department of Rail and Public Transportation. There were astonishing drops in the number of people taking buses and trains.
We were seeing ridership volumes down about 95% statewide, including looking at Washington Metro, where we've actually seen rail ridership has been down, less of an impact on bus ridership. And there's a sense in the D.C. area that there are riders that typically were using rail that are also using bus now. Overall, though, ridership has been coming back slightly. We are seeing now about 90% volumes. That's the same on rail ridership and Amtrak as well.
So we've covered trains and automobiles, but what about planes? Here's Kathy McGee, the Director of Research and Innovation at the Virginia Transportation Research Council.
As you can imagine, the impacts on aviation have been quite extreme. They hit a low nationwide of about 4% of normal passenger throughput at TSA checkpoints. We've seen somewhat of a rebound, and we now stand at approximately 20% of normal in terms of traveler throughput at those TSA checkpoints.
Now, I'm very interested in what all of this has meant for air quality. I'd like to see, and I'm seeking out more information about what climate benefits might have come from this slowdown. How can we use this moment to imagine something different? And in part, that's kind of the questions you're going to hear in our next piece. After this short break, we'll have an interview with Cynthia Hurst, the director of the Foothills Child Advocacy Center. During this time of continued and sustained crisis, many in the community are struggling. The Center for Nonprofit Excellence has spent time considering the issue, and they have been interviewing people for a series on hope and resilience. Here's another installment, and your host will introduce herself.
Hello, my name is Lee Catlin. I'm a board member of the Center for Nonprofit Excellence, and I'm really pleased to welcome you to this installment of CNE's series, Hope and Resilience Conversation. What we at CNE are finding is that in these times of challenge and change, it's really important and very grounding for us to call on and pay mind to the wisdom and the experience and the perspective of area leaders who are on the front lines of service in our community to really kind of have some conversations that help us be inspired, be comforted, be refreshed, and gain some new insights. So I am really pleased today to give a very warm welcome to our guest, Cynthia Hurst, the Executive Director of Foothills Child Advocacy Center. Cynthia is an old friend of mine who finds herself in a new critical role in this community at a moment of incredible challenge and opportunity. Cynthia has been active in our community and many other places for a long time, building community collaboration and supporting social causes. And she now finds herself sitting in a new seat. So I would like to start our conversation with Cynthia by asking her just to introduce herself, take a moment or two to tell us a little bit about her and her journey and where she finds herself now at Foothills.
Oh, thanks, Lee, and thanks so much for including me in this series. I think it's so important right now that we acknowledge everything that's going on and that we continue to talk to one another about how we can support each other and all the critical work that everyone's doing to keep people safe and build community right now. I've been a part of the Charlottesville community for about 20 years. As you mentioned, I've worked in a lot of other places as well, big cities, small towns, always with nonprofit organizations. I got my start with Clean Water Action as a canvasser, knocking on doors, asking people for money in January in Baltimore. And I've moved on to work with a lot of different types of organizations, social justice, environmental. Most recently, I worked with the International Campaign for Tibet in D.C. I also worked with the local PBS station here for a while, which is how I got to know a lot of people in the community. And I came back to Charlottesville recently to kind of reroute myself in not only this community, but in nature. In D.C., I didn't get as much of that. And I'm so glad that I did come back when I chose to, because this position with Foothills was available. And now I'm able to help the children and their families who are dealing with abuse.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the tour through your journey and getting here. It helps us to understand some of the perspective that you bring here. And I guess, Cynthia, just to start off the conversation, you have been in a lot of circumstances over time that have been challenging. We certainly find ourselves in a number of challenging circumstances right now. How do you hold on to hope during times of crisis? What are the ways that you find yourself remaining hopeful?
Well, as we've already pointed out, I became the executive director of Foothills Child Advocacy Center at the beginning of this pandemic on March 23rd. So I came on board in a whirlwind of change when the governor just declared us a first responder organization. And I quickly saw that we as an organization, as a country, as a planet, are moving forward into a new era. We're not going back. And that can give me hope because I don't want in many ways for us to go back. Right now, Foothills Board of Directors meets virtually, like most of the other groups today. One of our board members has had difficulty coming to meetings due to physical challenges, but now he can attend more often. And going forward, we'll maintain this option. Our environment is becoming cleaner with less fossil fuel usage. It's benefiting from, people pulling back, reducing pollution. And we now know that we can make a difference if we choose to do that. Also, I've seen the community coming together to support one another in so many ways with food and masks. At Foothills, we help abuse children and their families. So the children are already traumatized and we didn't want to scare them with masks. So I reached out to Charlottesville Craft Aid and they came to the rescue with clear masks so our staff and the children can see one another. And obviously, also, working with children and seeing our future every day, I have to have hope.
Thank you. That's a great story about the masks and such a good example of how we are all learning as we go. Cynthia, you had the opportunity to reflect back probably on your younger self, as we all do. And what do you think you know now about hope that perhaps you didn't know earlier in your life?
Well, when I was younger, I just had hope. I followed my gut, my intuition, my instinct, whatever you want to call it, and I just knew everything would be fine. I believed in the basic goodness of everyone. If someone told me something, I believed them. Like most people who've been on the planet for a bit, like me, my view became tainted over time. You know, betrayals, cruelty, trauma, other things. And I understand now how someone can fall into despair. And I've also learned it can pass. If we let it go, if we work to relearn what we were born knowing, difficult times remind us of our humanity and how the best way to improve our mental state is to help someone else and feel connected again. I had to relearn what my gut told me when I was younger. People are basically good, and that gives me hope.
Let's talk a little bit about the fact that this is the situation we find ourselves in can be very wearing. It can be very grueling. You're in a position of leadership, a brand new position of leadership. Keeping yourself centered and grounded and refreshed has got to be a challenge. What supports you on your capacity for resilience in this environment?
Well, I have a lot of go-tos. Meditation is a wonderful way for me to reset. Some people would call it prayer. Others look at meditation as a way to clear their mind. Buddhists contemplate a specific idea, like hope, for instance, which I sat with for a while before this call. One of the best meditation teachers I know once told me that he likes to feel in his body by exercising. This takes him away from what people in the meditation world call the monkey mind thoughts. And we're all familiar with that, particularly now, you know, how you just, your mind can go, 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 and you can't sleep, or you're watching stuff on the news too much and you're thinking about that all the time. I tend to hike, to bike, to do my yoga. Those are all a great way for me to return to a more positive state of mind, to having hope, as you know, is the subject of the discussion today. If I stray into anger or resentment for all the horrible things that are going on in the world, those are helpful tools for me. I'm the sort of person who tends to speak up when I see something I believe is unjust, and I'm still working to remain not judgmental in those moments. I don't have it all down yet. But because I feel I don't want to feed the polarization that is so prevalent right now, I try to remind myself that we all have a shared humanity. And I try to remind others of that, too.
Thank you, Cynthia. The yoga thing is kind of my go-to, too. I finally was able to get a yoga mat from Target. They were sold out really early on. You know, you touched on something about the anger and trying to stay away from the anger. And it makes me think that much of the anger that's out there is being driven perhaps by fear. And so in circumstances where there does feel like there's threat out there, when there does feel like there's uncertainty, how do you as a leader kind of lead with bravery instead of fear in these very uncertain times?
Right. Well, I realize bravery isn't really the absence of fear necessarily. It's rather a moving past it and doing what I believe is best. I tend to be kind of a mama bear wanting to protect everyone in my world, but I believe the bravest thing I can do is to be myself, to be vulnerable and honest with everyone about whatever's happening and to be open to hear their concerns, then doing what is best for all concerned with conviction. Every day after my morning yoga, I say, may I listen, may I hear, may I do what is best for all concerned. And I feel like if I follow those self-imposed guidelines, I rarely feel trepidation.
You touched on this a little bit too, the need to stay connected to the human part of all this. I think particularly as we are trying to lead organizations that have tasks and practical matters and things you have to get done, you can get detached from the human part of all this. So how do you stay connected to compassion while we're in a world where so many difficult things are having to get done?
Yeah. I find if I take the time, if I have the time, if it's, you know, the right setting, to listen to someone else's story, I can build my compassion and my trust in others, as well as their trust in me. Reminding myself that we all want to be happy, and we all want an end to suffering, helps me to release my anger. If I don't have a way of knowing their story, like someone not wearing a mask in the grocery store or someone cutting me off in traffic, I make one up. And they just received some terrible news, had a fight with their spouse, lost their job, whatever. This helps remind me how vulnerable we all are and how similar we are too. I think it was Mr. Rogers that said, I should have looked this up ahead of time, but there's no one you cannot love if you simply take the time to hear their story. So that's kind of my go-to for compassion.
That's a great reminder. It really is. Okay, last question, Cynthia. There's a lot of examples of leadership at a lot of different levels going on right now. What do you think is the most important quality of a leader during the kind of challenging times that we're facing?
Well, right now, I find that people are still wanting to cling toward a plan for knowing what's going to happen. But we never really did know. You know, someone joked that I guess everyone who said, you know, in an interview what they'd be doing in 5 years, 5 years ago, got it wrong. So all we can do really is work with the now. I feel it's important to take stock of the present moment and deal with what we know for certain in the now. I'm working to operate with short-term planning and flexibility, to encourage creativity and innovation through asking lots of questions, being new in my position, seeking to understand how things work, listening to others' concerns. I also feel that my years of experience helped me to calm those who may be freaking out a little bit with everything that's happening. Our country's grappling with a worldwide pandemic on top of hundreds of years of racial injustice. Leaders need to instill confidence in those whom they are leading, that they are doing what is best for those whom they are leading. I was a little while back when I was a consultant with nonprofits, I was waiting outside of a board meeting to go in with another presenter to talk to them about where their organization was and where it was heading. And the other person asked me, what's our main message? And I said, it's the same message we always give everyone. And that is, it's all going to be okay. Everything's going to be fine. We're going to work together and it's going to be fine. And I think that's what leaders need to do right now. They need to step up and say, everything's going to be fine. We're going to work together and it's all going to be okay.
You've been listening to Lee Catlin interviewing Cynthia Hurst of the Foothills Childhood Advocacy Center. This is part of the Center for Nonprofit Excellence's Hope and Resiliency Conversation Series. This has been another installment of the Charlottesville Quarantine Report. We'll be back later this week with another edition. Drop me a line at wordcast@gmail.com if you'd like to learn more about the show, what's going on, and how you might be able to get involved. I'm Sean Tubbs, and thank you for listening.